Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we are back. It's Derek Madden, Matt Kolsky, the Toy Department. How was your Memorial Day weekend?
Nice. I ate a lot of ribs yesterday, you know, spent some time with the family. All told, very good stuff.
Did you make a big mess with all those ribs?
I mean, there's a bit of natural mess that comes with ribs, but...
Not if you're on Top Chef and eating in a car.
No, I mean, there is a mess there. That was exactly the problem. Speaking of which, I guess that's where we start, right? Top Chef?
We should start at Top Chef.
Chris is gone. Thank God.
And Chris, who... It almost reminded me of the Challenge OGs, where it was just like, Chris was just like determined to make bad pasta until he went home, and he finally succeeded.
Yes, he was hanging by a thread for weeks, just making bad pasta week after week until finally, and they almost had me. I thought for a second they were about to send someone good home again. I was like, stop this. You must stop this.
It's clearly weird because he is good at other things. But
I'm guessing you did not watch Last Chance Kitchen, because this set up a tremendous Last Chance Kitchen for a variety of reasons.
This was the car Last Chance Kitchen, right? I have not gotten a chance to watch it yet.
Yes. So, okay. Then you realize, though, that even though you have not yet watched it, it is we've talked already about how product placement has really leveled up this season.
I'm assuming it's a BMW thing, right? Since I saw the scene of Tom driving cars.
It's next level product placement here. but it also is an incredibly fast, exciting, quick, Last Chance Kitchen matchup. And maybe most interestingly, because she's so sweet, and even as she says these things, she's trying to be nice about it, you can tell that Sarah feels some type of way about the fact that it was her and not Chris eliminated the previous week, and she wants to whoop his ass.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That doesn't sound very Sarah-y.
She does it in the most Sarah-y ways, right? It's like, you know, this was kind of important to me because I felt like I, you know, like she talks around it, you know what I mean? But it's clear that she's like, this guy can't cook my underwear. I can't believe I got sent home instead of him. Let's get him the hell out of here. And she does.
It's interesting because it seemed like there were a lot of contestants remaining on the show this week who it seemed like they felt like it could have been them. But Chris did not seem to be among those.
Yeah, well, he was riding high on the hog from cooking bad pasta and getting to stay over and over again.
I guess. I mean, the dude did win some challenges, right? It wasn't like he was completely worthless.
I feel like he had one week where he like popped up and won a couple things and finished in the top, but like he was clearly the worst chef on the show for a few weeks now, right? Like this is rating, you know, you're picking, it's all, these guys, they're all great, right? We got to do this disclaimer or whatever. It's not, I'm sure he makes great food, but he's been consistently.
Well, I think that we're seeing a stratifying now.
Yes.
As we're getting down to the end, right, of these contestants, where there's a top group, which is, you know, Gabe and Don and Shota at this point, and maybe Sarah rejoins that should she win Last Chance Kitchen.
Thing. Sarah was in that group.
She was, clearly in that group. But as I said last week, like, prime legit contender getting knocked out in Restaurant Wars is a time-honored Top Chef tradition. So,
I know. It's just annoying when, like, to me it's silly. if you've got Chris and Sarah there and they both have a bad week, it's silly to send home the one that you know is like one of the favorites and keep the one who you know has no shot.
Yeah. Per Wikipedia, Chris has 0 wins this season. I could have sworn he must have just won Quickfires. Is that right?
Or, yeah, I think he won a Quickfire and he like maybe finished in the top at one point, you know?
Only once. Yeah, only once, week 4. And then was in the middle in week – or, sorry, finished high in week 4. Yeah, was in the middle in week 1 and week 5. And then low in the bottom 3 in every other week. So
that's what I'm saying, man. He's been
just
bad.
Just from a record standpoint, clearly the worst chef remaining. That is correct.
Clearly.
I'd say not even close, really, if you're just looking at colors on this Wikipedia page.
Right, and I would say he's been that for a while. So I you know, yeah. I forget who it was. It was like him and Gabe and who was the other bottom chef? It was somebody else good.
It was not Gabe won.
Oh, you're right. No, Gabe was in the bottom restaurant world.
Yeah, it was Jamie. It was Jamie and Byron, who I would say are also people in that second tier is chefs who don't seem to be as talented as the first tier, but are capable on their week. You know what I mean? Of jumping up and beating anybody.
Right. You're right. I was crossing it with the previous week. But nevertheless, yeah. Like Jamie and Byron, like, okay, so this was the one where Byron just put everything in a bowl and it was not as interesting as it should have been with his recipe, right?
Yeah. It was a couple things, right? He made a really bland dish.
Right.
And
the recipe was 10 pages long.
Yeah, it was a ridiculous recipe,
right?
With payoff. So,
like, here's the thing: that's he made a mediocre dish and a bad recipe. But like, Chris just messes things up, like badly. And not only did he have a bad recipe and also a mediocre dish in the same way that Byron did, but he did it by making the exact same mistakes he's been making every week, like. And some Byron's recipe was too long, but Chris forgot to say like how much flour to put in the dough for the gnocchi. Like what, you know?
He clearly had some conception problems too, and I think that goes back to the ribs thing, right? Like
right,
just bad ideas to start with, and. It's not that he can't cook. It's just, you know, he's not cooking in a way that's going to turn a bad idea into a workable one.
No, and it's very clear that this is not his format, you know?
Yeah. I think to go back to my tears point, I think that any of these dishes in the bottom three this week were worthy of sending somebody home. Chris's was the worst, and I think that was the right decision. But the kind of dishes that Byron and Jamie made are dishes that get you sent home on lots of seasons. So
yeah, Jamie got a little weird with the foie gras, but
yeah, and the soft on soggy, and it was sweet. Like those were not like, oh, there's just, you just made one little mistake and that's the difference. Like these are
no
dishes.
Yeah, that's three. Not what I'm saying though. In fact, I'm kind of saying the opposite, that like they were all bad, but to me, like, the tiebreaker should be that Chris has been sucking in the same way for weeks now. You know,
I don't even think it was – like, I don't know. I feel like we're arguing when we agree. Like, Chris made the worst dish. I don't even think it was a tiebreaker. Like, I think Chris made the worst dish, and Chris got sent home, and deservedly so. Yeah.
Okay, maybe. I guess all I'm saying is, like, I think that there were times in that episode – I felt the same way the previous week and probably the week before that as well. And so there were times in this – episode as they were doing the judges table that it felt to me like they were gonna somehow not eliminate Chris again, and it was very nerve-wracking.
Yeah, see that, I think maybe that's where we differ. Like I felt like any of those, like Chris made the worst dish and I'm fine with the way it played out, but I felt like all of those people made bad dishes, and if any of them had gotten sent home, I wouldn't have been real mad about it.
Well, see, that's, you know? And that's the point I was trying to make, is that for me, you're right, all three of them made bad dishes, but if three people make bad dishes, to me, the tiebreaker should be this guy's been making bad dishes week after week. So,
and again, I don't think it was tied. I think Chris made the worst dish.
I know you keep saying that, but that's not the point. I'm just saying philosophically, like, it feels to me like he has been in and around the bottom for weeks. And whether it's a tie or just like he's slightly better, like, I can't. There's nothing to explain to me why Sarah was sent home instead of him, really, other than maybe like drama. So,
I don't know about that. Like, the show is pretty consistent about we don't consider season long achievement.
I'm saying maybe they should, because like to me those slight differences in the dishes it's a pretty arbitrary choice.
Whereas I don't know. They've been showing you a more interesting television show, to be honest.
That's what I'm saying. I think they do that to make it a more interesting television show, because if they considered season-long performance, like you'd get a good feel for who's going to get eliminated each week ahead of time. But in this format, they really emphasize the week to week. So if you know a great chef has a bad week, the show gets shook up. And I get that, but I guess I'm saying I just want to keep seeing Sarah cook, and I don't care to see Chris cook anymore.
Well, look, I think there's a pretty good – I mean, I don't know. That said, not having watched any Last Chance Kitchens, I still feel like there's a pretty good chance you'll see Sarah cook again.
I saw her cook this week, and I'll see her cook next week for sure, and probably she'll be back in the competition sooner than later. I'm just saying, like, that's how I would do it.
So
if I could tell this incredibly successful television show what I would prefer they do
– I think you just did.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is if I am Byron and Jamie and Maria, I'd be watching out these next couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's trouble. You're in trouble.
Because your times are high.
Although I got to say, I keep saying this, the closer they get to like, all right, cook us some of your food, the better Maria is.
Agreed. She did great this week, even though she wrote a crappy recipe.
Yeah, I felt bad for her because even when they showed some of the bits from her recipe, it was like, well, English is very clearly not her first language, and like writing in English is a tough ask for her. You know what I mean? And of course, because she's Maria, she made a gigantic bowl full of meat, but
yeah,
it worked.
Seemed to be a problem. I didn't get a language issue there. You know what I mean? It was like, to me, it was much more about the quantities of food that she used.
Oh, no. But she always does that. She even said it later. She said, like, I think some of my recipe got lost in translation. And when they showed a bit, it looked like someone who speaks Spanish, right? Trying to write in English and they're not used to it. You know what I mean? Because there was like a little clip that was like, it was incomplete sentences.
And look, in fairness, they seem to forgive her for all of that.
They did. Really. That's what I'm saying. I'm just saying, like, I felt a little bad for her because, like, the writing portion clearly was a challenge for her that at a level that I don't think it was for anybody else.
I did think this was a conceptually cool challenge.
Great idea. And what a cool way to tie in the pandemic and also, like, make it, you know, they've embraced the hipster Portland, obviously, and this also is the least offensive Fred Armisen I've ever experienced.
I was just about to say we have gotten all this way and not talked about your nemesis Fred Armisen.
He's not my nemesis. I just think he's creepy on screen, and I have to say in this episode I found him charming.
Podcast nemesis, come on.
He's not I don't know. I don't want to do that. I don't know the guy. I have nothing against him. He just creeps me out.
He's not your real life personal. It's like, you know, it's like sports hate. Like, I understand you don't hate Fred Armisen.
Okay, well,
podcast nemesis.
Fine. You know what I mean? He can be my nemesis, but the point is, like, I actually found him charming and cute and funny on this. I thought they're like, they made me laugh. The two of them, part of it is Carrie Brownstein makes him a lot more palatable.
They're great together, and they're doing their Portland bit, and I agree that it would have been, honestly, it would have been weird for them to get out of the season without doing some sort of Portlandia thing.
Totally. Right? So. They had to, and it was cool that Dawn won after she was like, I love Portlandia. And she had an what'd you say?
I did not see that coming.
Nor did I, but Dawn had an incredible line where she was like, yeah, I really like Portlandia. Like, I just think it's so funny, and I'm learning very realistic.
Yeah, she's like, now that I'm here, Dawn's a delight. And
she's so good.
Yeah, man, she's cooking really well right
now. You know, some people just are born to win at everything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Reminds me of Steph Curry a little bit. Like if you talk to people who've hung out around Steph Curry, like they'll tell you no matter what thing is around, he will beat you at it. Like just whatever it is. ping pong, pool, like just like if anything's around, Steph Curry is ready to beat you at it. And I feel like that's Dawn.
Yeah, I kind of get some of that vibe. But yeah. She is not, you know, you see the ultra competitive in her, but it really feels mostly inwardly directed.
She's a
right?
tremendous like, sport. Yeah.
Maybe that's because she's an individual sport athlete or something. You
maybe,
know what I mean?
But I don't know that there's no like direct connection here, obviously, but like she carries like the traditional Olympic values incredibly well. You know, like the spirit of competition and like she's a great sport. She's a great competitor. She's so good at what she's doing. She's really putting so much passion and consideration into it. Like I hope Dawn wins now that to be honest with you.
Mm.
But Gabe is a heavy hitter, man.
Between Dawn and Gabe, man.
Yeah, it really is. And when they said you should make a cookbook just full of sauces, my wife and I looked at each other and were like, we would buy that cookbook.
Yeah, 100%. yeah, for sure. So I did want to ask, this is almost like a little show planning thing that we're going to do now on the pod, but did your episode come with that preview of Top Chef Amateurs?
No.
Oh.
Well, maybe, but we've skipped the commercials, so I missed it. Is that a new show?
It was not skip the commercials. Like, so I mean, I just taped it off of television.
Yeah.
But on, you know, Bravo ran 30 minutes of Top Chef Amateurs after the episode. 30 minutes.
Oh my God. You know what I mean? No. No.
So I don't, you know,
does that mean kids?
No, it's not kids. It's I kind of think this is Gail's concept.
Oh, so wait, does Gail become, hold on. Are you telling me Gail is the Padma?
Yeah, Gail is kind of the Padma.
I'm in.
And what
you know, I love Gail. Ever since Fake Gail did that one season, I'm all in on Gail.
Yeah, I need real Gail. Give me real Gail.
Real Gail is the only Gail for me.
So the idea is they take two people, like, you know, one was like a food blogger and one was a home cook from Texas.
Like cook amateurs.
Yeah. So home cook amateurs. And then they pair them with top chefs. It was Dale and Kwame in this episode. And and then they make stuff. You can compete. So, yeah, that's basically.
Oh, man. Well, I got to add that to the old DVR list right now.
Yeah, and like the one of them was just so geeked out to work with Kwame. It was pretty adorable.
But the other one got to work with Gail?
With Dale. Dale.
Oh, Dale. Oh. That makes
And that was
sense.
Also great because she was like, you know, Dale was kind of a dick on his season, but he's been really nice to me. She wasn't all that excited at first, but then she was really happy when they started working together.
That's funny.
So it was great. Yeah, it was cool. You know, the one of the chefs was Bengali and they did a little thing about Fatima and kind of like a little tribute to her and how much it meant for her to see her cooking in that season. And yeah, it was good. It got a little dusty in my house in the Top Chef. I don't, you know, my one worry about it, and I don't want to get too far into it because it's premiering in July. It does seem like it's easier when you have contestants who are on for an entire season. And I feel like it's one thing we've learned rather than new contestants every episode, you know, because you get to know people. And I think this show obviously seems like they're changing out people every episode.
I wonder why they didn't do it in the same. Maybe it's a matter of, you know, it's difficult. Maybe it's a pandemic concern.
It sort of looks like they filmed it in Portland too, and just like in the same kitchen and whatever. So I don't know how that all that stuff works, especially since it was the same, you know, two of the guest chefs from this season in that one episode.
Were they in Portland? Did you know? Well,
they didn't say, but it looked that's what it looked like.
Okay.
They didn't go outside. They were just in this kitchen in the
pre-. Right. In the same. Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
But it looked like the same.
Yeah, I don't know, but I'm in.
Yeah, so there you go.
Like, tell me where Gail's at, and I'm showing up.
All right. Anything else from this episode that you wanted to hit? I kind of think I'm good.
Yeah, I think I'm good.
Yeah.
There is Top Chef Junior. I should be paying attention more to the Top Chef spinoff collection.
Is that on the air right now?
It seems like no. It seems like it's seems like it ended a couple years ago. But
that's what I thought. Okay.
But there are two seasons of it out there, is what I'm saying.
Gotcha.
Yeah, there's not. I can't add Top Chef Amateurs to my DVR just yet. So.
Yeah, July 1st, I think is what they said.
All right.
Definitely sometime.
All right. I can.
All right. So there you go. Let's jump.
Like
you want to jump into the Friends reunion?
That show. Yeah, let's talk Friends reunion. We watched this last night. So did you understand what you were getting into?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I didn't totally know what it was. For some reason I was thinking Friends reunion meant like a reunion episode. But it was not that.
Yeah, I was aware we're doing a new episode for sure.
You knew they were not.
Yeah,
I hadn't thought about it, but I guess I just sort of, that was my presumption, and obviously that's not what it was. What this was an hour and 45 minutes of member berries, as my radio co-host likes to say. And I definitely was of the set that enjoyed and remembered Friends well enough to enjoy this thoroughly.
Yeah. How long did you say it was?
Hour 45.
Yeah. And I think that I understand why it was an hour and 45. I understand why they would want to make it as long as they could. You know what I mean? Like this is a get people to sign up for HBO Max.
And it's a long time coming. But yeah, I mean, they did not need any of the clips. You know, they could have done the exact same show. There's not one person who could have possibly enjoyed this who needed to see the clips.
I would disagree with that. I felt like
really?
I needed a glimpse. Yeah. Well, because I'm the person who's watched every episode, but probably hasn't watched it in 5 to 7 years.
But you don't
sense.
Think it would have jogged your memory if when they did the table read, you know what I mean? Like I'm with you. I'm right there with you. But everything they said, I was like, oh my God, it's the episode with the thing. And then that happens. And then that happens. I didn't need to see it again. I remembered it.
Like watching them go pivot. Like, yeah,
pivot. The outtakes are great.
The outtakes were fantastic. And that's, you know, this is the thing for me. It was a little bloated. Like, it didn't need to be hour and 45 minutes.
No, it didn't.
But
it's just member berries anyway. It's not, it's nostalgia.
All the parts that were the best to me were the parts where it was just the six of them talking. Whether it was the table reads or them being on the set. Or them playing that trivia game with the guest.
Yep.
And no shade to James Corden, who I thought did as good a job as you could do. And
he's exactly the guy you want to host this sort of thing, right? I mean, James Corden was perfectly cast.
His segments, though, I thought were just less interesting than the six of them. I would have rather just the six of them been on the couch talking.
I agree. Yeah. I don't think Corden was the problem.
Or Justin Bieber in a potato suit.
Right. It was the gimmicks that were the problem, not Corden. I could have done without the fashion show, but I thought some of the – I mean, like, they got a great question. They got a great result out of the what didn't you like question, you know? And I imagine they were sat out there for 3 hours listening to stupid questions, and only one or two of them made the show.
That and getting the nugget that, like, you know, Jennifer Aniston and Schwimmer almost hooked up, I thought was interesting.
Yeah, and then you got to see some behind-the-scenes video. It was like, oh, yeah, they definitely almost hooked up. You know? I think that was – it did. That made me feel things. And I think that's what this was. It was to make people who watched Friends feel things, and it worked.
I thought it did a pretty good job
of
that. Sure.
And, you know, like, I guess I would just say I hope that Matthew Perry and Courtney Cox are okay. I sincerely mean that in a not comedic way. It's hard to find a way to say that without being rude to them or insensitive or making fun of them. But, like, I'm a little worried about both of them, and I just hope that everything's okay.
What? So why are you a little worried about both of them?
They just don't look great. Like, Matthew Perry looks very much like a guy, and I know this guy in real life who's been in and out of rehab a lot. Like, he just looks both physically and emotionally like he's been through the absolute ringer, and he barely talked. And I'm projecting probably to some degree, but, you know, this is just judging people from the way they look on TV. It looked to me like it was really like hitting him in a place of like, oh man, this was my life. And like, you know, now what's my life? Like, he just looked like he was both happy and heartbroken to be there and like didn't quite know how to emotionally process it and like didn't have a lot to say a lot of times. And he shared that nugget about like, I went out there in front of the audience every night feeling like I would die if they didn't laugh, you know, just like stuff that probably belongs on a WTF podcast where he's crying. And that was a little hard to watch because that's, you know, I'm a Chandler guy. Courtney Cox was not quite like that, but also just like there was a sadness about her that made me a little sad.
Because I think, you know, look, I don't know what's going on in Courtney Cox's personal life at all. She's had, I think, a pretty reasonable career post Friends.
Yeah, she has.
So
she has. She's a little less out there than the other ones. You could very. If someone
sitcoms right after.
Yeah,
Friends.
She's been pretty successful. But if someone just showed you a photograph of those six people from Friends era and now, and asked you to identify the most successful ones, I think you could rank them in order just by looking at them.
Interesting. I mean, Phoebe's the only one with the original face, I feel like.
Schwimmer looks pretty good, and LeBlanc is just heavy, as some dudes get when they're in their mid-50s, but, like, he looks like he's aged pretty naturally. And it's not even just that. I mean, I do, like, the extensive plastic surgery makes me uncomfortable. It's weird to look at, and that goes for men and women, so, you know, whatever. But it's not just that. There was just something about her. I don't know.
I wasn't picking that up from Courtney. The Matthew Perry stuff, yeah. I think yeah.
And you know, anyway, that's neither here nor there. I think some of the most interesting things here beyond the obvious, like, I did think it was cool the way they went around the world. I did think it was cool the way they had really famous people. I mean, did you happen to watch the extras with Alice and Janney?
The extras, the television show with Alice and Janney? Or extras on this thing?
On this thing. So Alice and Janney didn't make the final cut, but she was one of the people, one of the famous people they interviewed about her experience.
Okay.
And it was so weird to see, you know, Alice and Janney, who's, what, probably 60, be like, yeah, when this was on, like, I felt like it was me, you know? Like, when they bought jean jackets, I bought jean jackets was one of the things she said. And I just thought of her because that was the last one I watched. It's in my head. Yeah, she's 61. She's older than all of them. But
that was the appeal of that show, right?
That's what I'm saying.
It's hard to explain to people. Yeah, don't watch it.
You saw everyone from like a pair of twins in like Ghana or something, who looked to be about 23, to Alice and Janney telling you how much this show meant to them, and. You know, like, I thought there was, like, an impassioned sort of monologue from, I want to say, a queer woman sort of saying to Lisa Kudrow, like, thank you for letting me be weird, you know? Like, there's just all this stuff that...
Yeah, or I think it was a Ghanaian woman who was like, I didn't have to marry the first guy who asked
me.
Yeah, like, that's not, look, I like that stuff. I like the interviews that they did with the three creators as well.
Yeah.
Got those added to stuff.
Really telling stuff from them.
That's just kind of what I mean. It's like, they could have done this without the Corden segments, and I think I would have been good.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I also thought it was fascinating to learn, and it's always like this when these sort of oral histories are told, like, the razor's edge that the casting was living on when they started it. And like,
yeah, that was great. And seeing that, what that, like that LAX sitcom.
Oh my God. The chance, the Matthew Perry. Oh yeah. My God. That is classic. Like early 90s garbage,
Fox.
Right?
Garbage.
Absolute garbage. And then just to think, like, when they were like, yeah, so if that TV show hadn't let Jennifer Aniston out of her contract, we would have had to recast Rachel.
And reshoot the first three episodes.
Right.
Yeah.
The sort of implication there is, and the entire course of American entertainment over the last 25 years changes.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, can you imagine? Just like, forget who might have taken the role. If Jennifer Aniston is not Rachel, think of how different the entertainment landscape is in so many ways.
Yeah. Imagine she had done that show that she was on, too.
Yeah.
Dumb small town waitress with a terrible rare steak joke.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's so wild. It's wild. And look, she might have been great at that, you know? Like, she's clearly a star. And if that sitcom had turned, you know, who knows what, one dumb joke in the pilot doesn't mean it was terrible. Like, Two Broke Girls has been on the air with a show about waitresses for years, right? So.
Telling terrible jokes.
Yeah. I mean, look, that show might have been a hit and she might have had a totally different career, but it would have been different, totally different from, you know, Jennifer Aniston is at the core or tangentially related to so much of everything in the entertainment world for the last 25 years. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's weird. It also was weird that, I heard Adam Duritz, you know, making the podcast rounds this week and like kind of finally talking about some like the times when he was dating Jennifer Aniston. And he also dated Courtney Cox, too, at the time, too.
Hey, so man, that guy got around. That he sure was a did. Busy man in the mid 90s.
Sure did. That had a real impact on his life too, I think, and on that band's career, which I also thought was interesting.
I did not know he was making the podcast rounds. I will tell you, man, I loved Counting Crows. I mean, August and Everything After is an incredibly important album in my life.
Yeah. Well, it lines right up with the Friends.
It sure does.
like, I mean,
And it's interesting, like, we knew at the time he was dating the ladies from Friends, but, like, it was just such a different time in the world. That's all we knew, basically.
Yeah. Well, and he, you know, not to get too into it, but he had never seen the show. Because, right, he was touring. And, you know, the one thing you don't watch when you're touring is primetime TV, right?
And also, like, he was weird. I mean,
he was like, she had to bring me the videotapes, like a box of videotapes for
yeah.
the show.
That's funny.
And I think when he met, she wasn't on it yet. It was also part of it. So I, you know, all of that I thought was, I don't know. I thought it was really, it was a fun trip down memory lane. And I thought that went as well as it could have.
I agree.
As well as we could possibly expect.
I think it went well. And I think, you know, like this could not possibly hold less interest to somebody who doesn't love Friends. But if you love Friends, I think this is going to give you what you want. It's a nostalgia play and it plays.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I also think it's very complete. Like, I would be
yes.
stunned if you got new Friends content after this.
They even said it, right? There was a point even where I think it was Courtney Cox was like, you know, this is the last time we'll ever be in a forum where we're all together being asked questions about Friends.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, it sure is. but, you know, you did get the feel and there's something like delightful and sort of comforting about it that they really love each other. Like these six people really love each other in a way that makes the show feel more authentic or something. I don't know. It's like when you love a show like that, it's heartwarming to know that the people involved love it and each other as well. And I bought that. I didn't feel like that was a put on.
Well, and I think it's one of those things, right? It's like, you know, baptism by fire, right? Like they went through this experience, you know, for better and for worse, that was completely unique. And these are the only other people.
Yeah, Schwimmer said that, right? Like the only five people in the world who could truly understand what I was going through are these five people.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
That's a hell of a bond, man.
Yeah, tough to break. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, I gotta imagine the cast of How I Met Your Mother has a certain bond, but it's probably not quite like that one. You know what I mean?
No, well, and I just think they were at different times in their lives and different points of their career, more so. Like, you know, it's Josh Radnor's first big role, and it's Allison Hannigan's, like, retirement savings.
There was a little bit of that on Friends, too. Like, people knew who Courtney Cox was. They talked
barely
about that in the cast. You know
they
what I
talked
mean?
About it. She was, like, just the girl from the Springsteen video.
You know, it's weird because I hadn't recognized a lot of the folks in that cast from other things, but I watched a lot of TV as a kid, clearly, because I, you know, remembered Matthew LeBlanc's prior television shows.
Right, but not like Allison Hannigan. I mean, she was in friggin' Buffy, and she was a viral sensation before that existed in American Pie, and like she had a whole ass career. You know, and Jason Segel.
Different stuff happened to them through the course of it, right? You know what I mean? Some of them had movie took off and some of them didn't. And,
that's what I'm saying. I mean, Colby Smulders is in the show on Marvel movies. There was nothing like that.
We didn't even get to what was going on with Neil Patrick Harris before he did that show.
Well, yeah. Again, like Neil Patrick Harris had a whole ass career and then a whole ass career comeback in Harold and Kumar. And then like it was even a couple years after that that they've got. To how you know what I mean? It's just not the same. I think plus you have to also remember that even if you were watching a ton of TV, like in 1994, to go from a few small parts to a major sitcom was to go from really unknown, broadly speaking, to known by everybody.
Yeah,
and it's just not like that now. Like you know, even Kobe Smulders probably had her acolytes before the show ever started because you can find everything and see everything and know where everyone is. I don't know.
Yeah, different time for sure. I did think before we get out of here, it was a little weird that we didn't get the Rembrandts didn't participate in any way, shape, or form, right?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with the Rembrandts. Do they still exist?
They just said no.
Why?
I don't know. I don't, you know, because I think that. That song, like, they were a band that had a music career, and that song kind of overshadowed it. You know what I mean? But I would also say, like, that song was it's just a perfect theme song for that. Like, it was right place, right time. Such a good fit for that show. And as, you know, I know it wasn't written as a sitcom theme, but as sitcom themes go, it's just, you know, it just worked. It all just really worked.
Yeah. I don't know.
The first sentence of the Rembrandts Wikipedia page is they are best known for their song "I'll Be There for You," which is the main song from Friends.
Yeah, but
they're still active.
That's weird. It is surprising that they weren't there, but maybe it just was. I mean, yeah, I don't know. They've only released one album since 1989, so like, I don't.
Yeah, first Rembrandts record is really good, by the way.
What's that?
The first Rembrandts record was really good. I thought.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that was 15-year-old me, so, you know, take that for what it's worth. But I definitely owned it and enjoyed it. All right. Should we move on to Plan B?
Yes.
Really had a great time watching Plan B.
Great movie. Great movie. Everything I was hoping it would be when I read a little bit about it. It's got a ton of heart. It's got great performances from the two young women at the center of it, and also all the goofy side characters that they encounter along their way. It's a pretty classic high school, we got a problem and we've got to go on a ridiculous journey to solve it type of format. But,
yeah, just kind of raunch to you, I felt like. You know what I mean?
Yeah, really, really. And just executed at a really high level. And shout out Natalie Morales, who, you know, we know from various acting roles, and I think this is a phenomenal directorial, I think, debut, but although I should probably look that up.
Yeah, maybe. It reminded me of, was it Bookworms? Was that the name of the...
Booksmart.
Booksmart.
Yeah,
yes,
Booksmart exactly. Or Good Boys. Like, it's definitely the same genre as those. It was her directorial debut. And yeah, I just thought it was great. I just thought it was a great little movie.
Yeah, me too. It was a lot of fun. I don't know if it's doing well, but I do hope people see it. because there are some buzzy things about it. And I was weirdly excited to see Harper from from that HBO show that we watched in the middle of it. I was like, oh, I didn't know you were in this. That's great. Was it in that show? In business? Industry. That's
industry. Yeah. Yeah.
Business.
Yeah, she was good too. And just like that. Yeah. There were so many fun little turns. The
Pierce penis bit was fantastic.
Tremendous stuff. Yeah. And by the way, that guy looked like what I imagine Riff Raff looks like if you take all his accoutrement off.
For sure.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out who that guy was. But yeah, no, the Rachel Dratch pops up. Edie Patterson is really funny. Just in general, a really, really high quality high school comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it's the kind of thing that I'm glad streaming's around for, because I don't know that this would make a theater in this day and age.
Yeah, maybe not. But I think this is, I think, maybe the perfect sort of talking point for me and my argument that this doesn't need to go to a theater. It does. And I think maybe that's the future of the theater model, that movies like this don't bother with it. Because, like, look, I wouldn't be unhappy to see this in a theater. I love the theater. But, and for me, a theater adds something to any movie experience, just the big screen, the darkness, the comfy chair, you know, we're in this place to do this thing. I enjoy that. But I don't think this film necessarily benefits anything in any specific way from being in a theater. And if the argument is, well, this couldn't, you know, the stupid movie industry won't make movies like this for the theater anymore, I guess I would say, okay, so then make a bunch of them that I can watch on streaming, because I'll do that. And then I'll go to the theater to see the F9, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if that's the argument, because I agree with you. And I don't think there's anything – this is not like a see it on the big screen kind of movie, for sure. I think all of that is correct. I just – I don't know. As someone who does like going to the theater and the movies, I would just wish there was just more variety of things, because I'm just going to wind up going to the movies less. That's just kind of how – you know what I mean? Like, that's what it is. So
yeah, I mean, maybe in the long run you go a little less, but I think you go for specific things that benefit from the experience, which I think is probably like where the theater experience belongs in the free market.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's just, look, they're just doing what the free market, you know. It's a little bit weird because they're pandering to the global market as opposed to the you know, free market in the American sense that we tend to think of.
The theater is, right, yeah.
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 But right, the movie industry is, right, because they need to make stuff that they can also sell in China and Italy and you know, everywhere else, right?
Yeah, but isn't that the advantage of movies straight to streaming? Like, this, I don't think this has any popular appeal worldwide, but this feels like a very American movie to me, but it's, yeah, great.
So, and there's a place to see it, and that's where I'll see it, but I would also, you know, I don't know. I'd like to be able to have more choices when I go to the theater.
That's,
and I'm
fair.
Not gonna,
yeah, that's
fair.
That's
my complaint.
Yeah,
more
I hear you. I it's a small complaint on my books. By the way, shout out Jay Chandrasekhar as well in this. Nice little role.
Let's, can we jump to Mayor of Easttown?
Absolutely.
I guess probably the Friends thing is probably the most watched thing, but I do feel like the second lead of this podcast, which would probably be Mayor of Easttown, that's going to be the most talked about thing in television this week, and I'm really glad that you caught up so we can talk about it, because I've sort of been dying to talk about it for 6 weeks now.
Certainly at least probably like 4 weeks, right? Because there was sort of a, like, this thing ratcheted up a level when all of a sudden it's like, yeah, I'm Katie Bailey. No one can hear you down here. There's a lot to this show.
It sure is. If I was Nicole Kidman, I would be very mad right now.
That they gave you The Undoing instead of Mare?
Yeah, like, I mean, because those shows to me are basically trying to do the same thing, and Mare is just on an entirely different plane, I feel like, on every level.
It's a better story, better told,
yep. and better acted.
Yep. Well, yeah, I mean, I nothing against Nicole Kidman, but this is just this better material.
Yeah, it's just such a fully realized world.
Yep.
And I think generally the show does so well exploring the trauma that's happening to these people as yep. much as showing it. Yep. And on top of that, it's a pretty cracking murder mystery. You know, if I had a complaint, I'd say maybe it was maybe one more twist / red herring than I really needed.
Well, I have one complaint. I have one complaint, and perhaps you can help me. Why was Dylan threatening that poor girl?
Yeah, they did not really solve any of that, right?
Like, he's got a gun in her face when she didn't tell anyone anything and he didn't do anything.
Right. And also, why do they need to destroy her journals? I mean, well, unless there'd have to be something else bad in there about him, right?
She kind of answered that, but not with any, not very satisfyingly. Like, what was her name? I can't remember the girl's name for some reason. But
friend's name?
Yeah. But she was I wanted to destroy them because I was afraid, you know, she'd get embarrassed. And she didn't want people to know who DJ's real dad was. But I think maybe when the girl found out who it really was, she was like, I have to keep evidence of this. So I get that part. I don't know what. And I guess I guess Dylan might have just been like, man, there could be all sorts of foul stuff about me in there. Probably best to just get rid of him.
You're talking about risking like.
Well, that's the thing. You're like breaking into an active crime scene and doing crazy things
and destroying evidence, which is in itself a crime.
Yeah, but right. Then maybe more to the point, after it's done, you're threatening this poor girl who, again, did not do what he's accusing her of doing. Like, she did not, at that point, she had not told the police that they destroyed the journals, right? Yeah. That was Mayor just guessed. And he's not at risk at that point. So I don't, like, if he didn't do anything, I don't, and the conclusion is he didn't do, it just doesn't make sense. But that was sort of a small thing in the end. I mean, this is as much about people as it was about the mystery, and the mystery is solved with, you know, to reasonable satisfaction. To me, what makes this show is just Kate Winslet and Jean Smart in particular, but just the acting across the board. I mean, Siobhan, the daughter, I thought was fantastic in this.
Stunned to find out. I don't know if you watched any of the like featurette.
I did not.
HBO Max had after, but like stunned to find out that she is from Australia.
Really?
Yeah, I had no idea.
Yeah, I did not know that. And I mean, look, if you didn't know that Kate Winslet was British, I think that, you know, that's a hell of a Philly accent. I know some people who talk just like that.
They had a little segment with the accent coach.
Oh, yeah.
I think was like the real MVP.
Oh, my God. I mean, the water and like they really nailed that Philadelphia area. It's a very specific accent.
Sure is. They crush it. It's a hard one to do, and everybody, everybody did it pretty well.
Angori Rice is her name, the actress who played Siobhan. She was also in The Nice Guys. I did not realize that.
Jess Riley is the name of Aaron's best friend.
Jess, right? So just in general, a good murder mystery, a deep, intense sort of family and city drama. Just a lot of good stuff here. High quality limited series. I imagine it is over. But also, I just got to say, watching this and then Hacks in relative proximity, the genius of Gene Smart is on full display.
Yeah, the smartisons continues unabated. she was great in this. I mean, it's not a huge role, but it's a pretty meaty role for her.
Yes.
I just love this whole town, like the way that you really get to know people in this town. They all have some pretty serious warts. A lot of them have some real trauma. The way that they just like, I mean, when you think about the emotional gut punches that Mare takes.
Yeah.
In the show, and almost all of them are earned. Like, people say some really horrible things to her, but you almost kind of always understand why, you know?
Yeah, she's not doing great.
People that do it out of spite, you know what I mean? Like, Brianna Del Rosso every once in a while said something, or like, you know what I mean? But like, man, it's tough.
Yeah.
And I thought the last scene, the way that they ended that was like, I don't know, was poignant and meaningful as well.
You know? Also, shout out Julianne Nicholson, who I thought was great in this too.
Yeah, for sure.
You know her from Law and Order: Criminal Intent, but
I don't. But you do. Yes.
Really? What do you know her from?
I don't know. I just feel like she's been in stuff. I don't know. I've seen her in things. Okay. But I did not watch Law and Order: Criminal Intent. She was in The Outsider.
Criminal Intent. Listen to yourself.
Or Criminal.
What it was?
Masters of Sex. That's probably where I was.
There you go. There you go. No, to me, she's always the detective who's trying to keep control of Vincent D'Onofrio in Law and Order: Criminal Intent.
I never got into that one. I pretty much, canon for me is the original L&O and some SVU. And outside of that, I never really.
Well, no, canon is just the original as far as I'm concerned. But at a certain point, you run out of those and you get into SVU, and then you run out of those and you're like, where else can I get my heroin? And it's Criminal Intent.
You're like the brother in the basement.
Yeah, that's right.
Give me some of that for you.
Fine.
I'll take organized crime.
Yeah, exactly.
This is what I got.
Exactly.
I can't wrap up also Mare of Easttown without saying, and I won't even spoil it, just on the off chance you haven't seen this yet, but like the twist at the end of episode 5 was when I was like, we need to be talking about the show, man.
Well, see, now I can't distinguish one twist from another.
The thing that happens in pursuit of the first killer.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. No, there's a holy moment in there. What the?
I mean, to me, that wasn't that the holiest moment, most holiest moment of the whole show? There were a lot of holiest moments, but that's
well, probably because it involved like sudden violence. It was the most shocking, I think. But there was a lot of surprising and upsetting stuff. There was a lot going on here, man.
Yeah, yeah, sure was.
You're probably right. The twist you're referring to, which I don't know why we're even hiding it, but I'll continue the charade. That's a big one, no doubt.
Yeah, I just feel like that one, I don't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it because it just hit me out of nowhere. You know?
Yeah.
Looking back, you can see how they kind of tip to it a little bit, but.
A very little bit.
When you're watching. Yeah, when you're watching, you don't.
No, no one saw that coming. And in fact, I was watching ahead of my wife on this because, I was afraid she wouldn't be able to get through it with me before today. And I even, when she was catching up, got a text from her like, did that just happen? So you're right. Yeah. That was the big hitter for sure.
For sure. I've been loving the show. I wasn't worried that you wouldn't be, but like I was, you know. I was worried because I knew you had to watch a bunch to get ready for this week. So
I did, and it was a lot, man. It was an intense binge, no doubt about it. But it's also good enough, and there were enough like cliffhangers and twists that it wasn't difficult to want to watch episode after episode of it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just glad I insisted when we were on the podcast last week.
You done good, kid.
Thank you. All right. Should we get into the homework for next week then? I don't have any surprises for you.
Do we want to check in on the playoffs at all? I mean, we're pretty much out of time, but do you have any quick thoughts on the NBA playoffs?
I, you know, it's starting to feel like a playoffs of attrition where it just may wind up being who's the healthiest at the end of this thing.
It sure is. But I'll tell you what, after watching game four of the Lakers, and I guess we'll see, look, tonight LeBron could take over and make me look like an asshole. But I got to tell you, I think the Suns are the best team here because Chris Paul looked pretty close to himself in that game four Suns win. And I thought if he was himself, they would beat the Lakers with Anthony Davis. So I still don't really believe in Utah, although Donovan Mitchell is truly incredible. I think the Suns should be the favorites for the West right now.
I was wondering what you meant when you said best team here by here. If you're saying the West,
yeah,
I would say it. Yeah, that's hard to argue.
Yeah, I mean, I think
that.
It's tough to judge. Look, Philly, we got to see what's going on with Embiid. Milwaukee has looked the best so far, just in terms of how they performed in the first round. They've been number one clearly. I mean, they're the only sweep. Brooklyn's been good, but I think it's important that we remind ourselves what a trash pile Boston's been this year before we get too excited.
Yeah, I think Brooklyn's got a gear that I'm not sure anybody else has.
They might. It's just Brooklyn, I just
flip out with them too. You know, they already lost Jeff Green, and I know. You know.
And they're pretty
there are
thin.
There are other guys in that team that matter outside of the big three, yeah, for sure.
Blake Griffin matters what I would call a disturbing amount if I was a fan of the Brooklyn Nets.
Yeah, and he's going to get attacked on defense at times, but it may not matter.
He's the best defender they've got, so
yeah.
Good luck. But it's going to be fascinating. And look,
Kevin Durant's the best defender they've got, by the way.
What's that?
Kevin Durant's the best defender they've got.
I mean, the best defender at the big position. You know, he's better than DeAndre Jordan or, you know, Nick Claxton might be the best. I don't know. Anyway, he's going to play a lot. Obviously, they're going to have to ask a lot defensively from Kevin Durant because the Bucks look really strong and Giannis is going to give them fits. So I'm very excited to watch that series. And as much as Brooklyn has looked pretty good, I am going to pick Milwaukee. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I don't know who I'm picking.
It's a tough one.
Series. That does feel like an right. You know, it's a little three way thing, right? Because yeah. You can't count the Sixers.
Well, it's just unless Embiid's hurt. If Embiid's hurt, you can go ahead and count the Sixers right out.
Yes, you can. And there does seem to be some weirdness going on with Ben Simmons, particularly at the free throw line right now.
Is it weirdness, or that's just who he is? Which is a problem if Embiid's hurt. Yeah. I mean, that's all.
Doc was quick to try to squash that last night. Like,
yeah, go ahead. But you're done if Joel Embiid's not right. So that's it. On the West side, Utah's pretty clearly going to win. Who you got in the other three?
Can I say it really doesn't matter who wins that Denver-Portland series? I think it's going to go seven, and it doesn't really matter because they're going to be cannon fodder for Phoenix or the Lakers in the next round.
That sounds right to me. Although, I think Denver's more trouble than Portland for either of those teams.
Maybe Denver doesn't look right to me.
They're not right. They're missing their second best player, but they're better than Portland as a feeling.
And MPJ has not been the same come playoff time, and I think that's important for them. Look, they should, if they were the Denver we thought they would be, they wouldn't be struggling with this Blazers team that just doesn't have a lot outside of Dame right now.
Yeah, but they need Jamal Murray.
But yeah, I think the Clippers are going to win that other series because Luka's not 100%.
Yeah.
And I don't know that you can, I mean, we left them for dead last week, and now I don't know that you can count them out of the West picture at all. They're a flawed team, but I think they're good enough to beat Utah.
All right. So, I mean, I crapped all over Kawhi Leonard and Paul George on every medium I had access to last week. So, in fairness, they were really good in games three and four. They took care of business once the star of the other team was injured. And you're right.
Kawhi's been great offensively all series. You know what?
Yeah, but that's not. Yeah, great. Congratulations. Although he has been better offensively the last couple games. But anyway, the point is just this is what's confounding about the Clippers. Everything I said about them being a you know, a bunch of dogs on, you know, throughout last week was true. They played like a bunch of dogs, but they're talented enough that, yeah, they could be the best team in the conference if they put it together. So that it is the weirdest one. And if Luka's not fully right, the Mavericks can't win. But if he is somehow, I think they can. So, you know, this is not over in my mind in the same way that, like, Utah, Memphis looks over or Atlanta, New York looks over, right? I just...
Yes, I, you know, as a you know, I'm not a Hawks fan, but I'm a fan of Atlanta sports, and I would caution anyone from saying that an Atlanta series is over just because...
Yeah, no, you're right. But, I mean, if you're watching that series, Atlanta has very, very clearly been the better team.
Other than one quarter where they basically, you know, just got... went real cold.
Yeah, but that's my point. I don't watch Mavericks Clippers.
They've been a better team all the way, but it doesn't mean they're going to win that series. Like,
no, I understand. But we're getting
which they lose.
We're getting distracted.
Anyway, it's not
the point. Yeah, it's not the point. The point is, like, when I watch Mavericks Clippers, it's not clear to me the Clippers are the better team. Like, it's clear to me when Kawhi and Paul George really bear down that they can win, but they don't do it enough to make them clearly the better team. So. The question remains with the Clippers, can they get this thing together? I will say that's sort of the Ty Lue's history as a coach and a championship winning coach is that his teams sort of get it together over the course of the playoffs. I don't know if that's just a coincidence or what, but it certainly seems possible. That said, I hate it because I don't think this is how you should do it. I hate the entitled.
The Lakers have a lot of get it together potential too, right? If they
but they're defending champs. Like maybe I'm overthinking all this, but like when you're the defending champs and you've reached that level and you know that level, then okay, work your way into it. The Clippers have accomplished nothing.
Damn.
Nothing as a team, and although Kawhi Leonard is remarkably accomplished as an individual. That doesn't count towards the Clippers' ledger. Like, you've got to do it here.
Putting Rondo's playoff history on the Clippers. Like, he's on the team, sure, but, like, you know
right.
what I mean?
Right, but the Clippers don't get those credits. So, in order for me to give the Clippers credit, I got to see them do it as a group. And, you know, two games.
I don't think
two games.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's trying to give them credit. I'm just, all I'm saying
no.
We left them for dead, and they are not dead.
You're
you know
right.
What I mean?
No, I'm not saying anyone's trying to give them credit. I'm saying they're acting like they deserve it.
Yeah. I you know, maybe what happened to them is the humbling that they need.
Maybe. We'll see. But my suspicion is we're going to see a team that looks like it needs humbling again soon. If not tonight or tomorrow, rather, then soon.
Can I switch gears for a second? Do you have any thoughts on this Naomi Osaka thing?
I have very complicated thoughts. I don't know that we have time. We're already over an hour here, but I guess what I would say to you is this. I have a lot of sympathy for people wanting to take care of their own mental health. And I think mental health should be better considered. And I do think there's probably a conversation to have about the format of post-match press conferences. I think there's a conversation to have about the level of professionalism that should be required from journalists who participate in those things. And, like, I'll be honest, I don't follow tennis enough to know exactly the issues in that realm that Naomi Osaka is upset about, if she is indeed upset. But I think that's a worthy conversation. I do not think this is the most productive way to get to that conversation. I think her initial statement wasn't good, frankly. If I understand her withdrawal from the tournament statement properly, then I think she failed to express herself in the way she wanted to in the initial statement. Because
she acknowledged in the second statement, right? I think she acknowledged that a little bit in the second statement.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think I understand her better from the second statement. The first statement, the way it read was, these media people don't believe in me, and I don't have to deal with that.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I get asked the same questions over and over again.
Right, and so if your complaint is these people, look, tournament organizers and some members of the media are careless with the mental health of athletes, and this needs to be addressed. I am with you, girl, 100%. If your point is these reporters sometimes repeat questions and occasionally think I'm not as good as I think I am, I have no sympathy for you because that's the job.
Right. That to me is it in a nutshell. Like, I think Naomi's great, and I fully support her taking care of herself, doing what she needs to take care of herself and looking out for herself.
Yep.
But I don't, I do think that it needs to be understood that yes, dealing with the media and being a representative of the game, particularly in an individual sport.
In an individual sport where you made $50 million off the court last year.
Right. And you, not forgetting even off the court, the on the court, right? The reason that the fees are what they are on the court is because people watch and are interested in tennis. And so, yes, like,
right,
having
but,
something to say to fans is part of that. You know what I mean?
Right. But like, let's even just put that aside, because I understand that there's a lot going on there in the prize money itself, right? There's a lot of noise, and effectively that's her performance reward, and she deserves it. The $50 million you made off the court is exclusively because you are popular as a human being. And you are popular as a human being exclusively because tennis is a popular sport which requires media coverage and attention. And those are not hard lines to draw. And, you know, there's two things. Number one, you made the $50 million because of the attention. And number two, you made the $50 million. So if you don't want attention, no one is stopping you from withdrawing from the tournament. And I think that's the right decision. If this is really about your mental health, take the time and try to get that in order in whatever means you need to. I fully support that. To say, like, I want the tournament and I want this tennis stuff to rearrange itself so that, like, to protect my mental health, that's a much bigger conversation that needs to be had in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, I just think there's a whole generational thing here, and I think you saw it, particularly with people coming to her defense. Like, you know, the world is not obligated to be an entirely safe space for you. And it doesn't mean that your mental health isn't important and that you shouldn't be looking out for that.
But you have access to every mental health resource you need, and and no one is forcing you to play. Right. And at this point, you've made so much money that you never have to play another public game of tennis in your entire life. If you really just love tennis and just want to play, you could build a tennis court and invite the best tennis players in the world to come play you one-on-one just for funsies. But if you want to show up to a massive Grand Slam tournament where there's an insane amount of attention and people want to hear from you, then just saying, I want to do this part, but not this part, it's not great.
Yeah. I thought Serena had a really great take on it too, which was, you know, like, hey, I feel for you, and I've been there, and I'd like to give you a hug, and I'm here if you need me in any way. You know, I went through a lot of these things, and some of them made me stronger. I think that, you know, that's maybe also part of it that she's not seeing, is that, like, you know, there's some unpleasantness.
There's going to be some tough times
with the sweetness, and sometimes that makes you a better person, and that you kind of have to confront that head on in some way. You know?
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's all right. I think we're on the same page. I'm not surprised.
Yeah. But you know, I also think, like I said, I do think some of that is really a generational thing. You know what I mean? That we're, you know, from a slightly older generation, and
I kind of hope not, you know? Because I really don't want to be the young generation is soft guy. And again, like, I totally support her working on her mental health. I don't think we want to get to a place where everyone's personal issues become the responsibility of the society to handle.
Yep.
You know, and everyone should respect her. And again, like, if we want to have a conversation about, like, there are some tennis media people getting way out of pocket, I think that's a worthy conversation, but I don't think this is how you have it.
Agreed. Agree. And I think Naomi would agree with that at this point, at least if her statement's in.
That's what it seems like. What it seems like. All right, let's talk homework.
Yeah, so we've got hold on, I gotta pull it up again.
Ah, jeez. You know?
All right, here we go. So for next week, Top Chef, of course. And then we're gonna watch Army of the Dead on Netflix. Bo Burnham's comedy special is getting a little buzz, so we'll check that out.
A lot of buzz. People, you know, and then there's, have you seen this response? To me, I feel like the universal response to Bo Burnham is like, wait, why are you so good?
I don't feel like a lot of people in my world really know Bo Burnham, to be honest.
Don't they know him as like a puppet act or something, you know?
Yeah, I don't know.
They're like, oh, the prop comic? And it's like, no, the incredibly talented film director and stand-up comedian.
Yeah, it's weird. And just he's a pretty good actor on his own too, right? I mean, if you know, Promising Young Woman's any indication.
I don't think he ever did puppets. I just, for some reason, I think he was a child star a little bit. Like, he's sort of been pigeonholed into this, oddity corner that I don't think he belongs in.
Yeah. No, I probably need to know more about the rest of his career. And then the other thing we're going to watch is, I just wrote Lady Parts. That's not the name of the show.
It's called We Are Lady Parts. It's a new British television show about a Muslim punk band.
And that will be on Peacock.
Yes.
So we don't know if Kolski will be able to see more than one.
Well, I don't even think more than one is being released. So I think it's just it's a weekly release. So I think there will only be one.
Great. So we'll talk about that one and probably some other stuff too.
Probably some more sports nonsense and probably another podcast that goes on about 15 minutes longer than we intended. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.